Thank you very much. As always, my beloved, we are in the book of Acts, in chapter 15, at verse 37. And Barnabas determined to take with them John, who was called Mark. As you will remember from last time, after some time had passed while they stayed in Antioch, preaching the gospel and teaching the things of heaven, bringing the good news to those who had not yet come to know it and instructing those who had, that is, constantly catechizing, they had already discussed it. That is, Paul, the apostle, had proposed to Barnabas that they return and visit those places where they had preached the gospel. Barnabas had no objection, and so they had to set out, but they also had to take along some helpers. That is why it says that Barnabas thought to take John Mark along with him. You see, once again, they are on the move, looking for fellow workers. Barnabas wanted to take Mark, but why? Because Mark was Barnabas' nephew, and you will remember that on their first apostolic journey, Mark was with them. But he abandoned them in Pamphylia and turned back to Jerusalem. Do you remember that? And he left them either because he was afraid of the ordeal they were facing, especially since a little further on Paul would be stoned at Lystra to the point of nearly being killed, or else because Mark had been scandalized by the conduct of the two apostles, Barnabas and Paul, who so readily made the Gentiles, the idolaters, into Christians. That is, he had somewhat remained where he stood. Perhaps he had somewhat remained in the position of the Judaizing Christians, of whom we have spoken several times, who said that you first had to pass through Judaism and only then become a Christian. So it seems that Mark had been somewhat scandalized, and that is how he came to abandon them. Whether out of fear or out of being scandalized, the point is that he abandoned them. But after the Apostolic Council, Mark revised these positions of his. So it appears, the book of Acts notes nothing about it for us, and now that his uncle Barnabas asks him to follow them as a helper, he has no objection. Now, he wants to go. Of course, he had lost an opportunity. He had lost the opportunity to live through the cross-bearing ordeal of that first missionary journey. And as Oikumenos says, Barnabas received him because he had repented. He accepted him because he had repented. But this is how things stand when Barnabas proposes that they take Mark. It was not Paul who proposed it. It was Barnabas. And we move on to the next verse, the 38th. But Paul thought it not right to take him with them, who had departed from them from Pamphylia, and had not gone with them to the work. On the contrary, Paul says, he insisted that the one who had abandoned them, somewhere there in Pamphylia of Asia Minor, who did not come to the work of the mission, that this man should not be taken along with them. Pay attention. Here we have a beautiful passage, beautiful in the sense that it shows us certain facets of some very interesting matters. Paul held the opposite opinion regarding taking Mark along. This word he uses, that he thought it right, that is, he held it as just, means that Paul considered it just that the one who had deserted the work should not be taken along. The one who, it was just to say, you abandoned us, and now we should take you. Why? When perhaps you might do the very same thing to us again. Nevertheless, this was Paul's view, while Barnabas's view was that Mark should be taken along, that they should take him. You see here that even the saints have their own opinions. Paul was absolute, because the work was not his own. It belonged to God, and he could not be lax with it. Barnabas, on the contrary, saw things more in human terms and more leniently. In any case, each man's opinions matched the character he had, and these opinions, of course, were decisive enough to be put into effect. Notice here, this is the first time we see the two apostles, Paul and Barnabas, putting forward differing opinions. Oikumenios says, Paul sought what was just, while Barnabas sought what was loving toward man. That is, what was Paul saying? It is not just for us to take him, he abandoned us, he should not come. Barnabas looked at the loving side. Well, he was young, he has changed, he has grown, he has matured more. It does not matter, let us take him. John Chrysostom continues the commentary as follows, filling it out. Thus also among the prophets we find different opinions and different temperaments, as Elijah was severe, Moses was gentle, and so here, too, Paul is the more vehement. This both helped the others and set Mark himself right. That quarrel was of great benefit to Mark, for Paul's severity turned him back, while Barnabas's kindness, that gentleness of his, kept Mark from being cast off for good. So too among the prophets, says John Chrysostom. We find them holding different dispositions. Elijah is stern, Moses is gentle, and here Paul appears the more vehement. Yet even this conduct of his was correcting and training Mark. This dispute did him great good. The dispute between Paul and Barnabas benefited him greatly, because the one, with his severity, said no, while the other, with his leniency, said yes. Let us take note of this, my beloved, and make a comment here. These are the different ways of approaching a subject. In other words, they are different opinions. One object, one thing, one matter. Each person sees it differently, without ceasing to be inspired by God. He nevertheless has his own personal position. So, if we see two saints holding a different opinion on a common matter, this should not scandalize us. Let us take very careful note of this, because we often say, but how can this be? Further on, John Chrysostom will tell us. What are the saints, stones, and pieces of wood, that is, persons who are not really persons, who move in some mechanical way, moved by the Spirit of God without having any opinion of their own? But how can that be? We will see this a little further on too. No, my beloved, each one can hold his own opinion in interpreting a passage of the gospel, and those positions in two interpretations, or three, or four, or five interpretations, can all be correct, all of them. For a passage in the gospel does not lay down that this single point means only one thing. So we can have a different opinion, provided, of course, that the matter is not doctrinal or moral. It is, so to speak, a matter of indifference. In any case, the method, the way of doing it. One person may have a certain strictness and the other a certain leniency. This is not something destructive, so long as these two positions work together. As a method, this can be used wonderfully in school, at home, even in the army if you like, and in a workplace outside, with employees if you want. That is, take the home as an example, what one side, or one parent, should support. The father may maintain a certain strictness, and the mother a certain leniency. But notice here, neither will the strictness go beyond certain limits, nor will the leniency go beyond certain limits. The child, seeing the strictness of the one and the leniency of the other, take note, is not harmed, as it could be harmed in the case where one is strict and the other gives in completely, and says, for example, the mother saying, "Leave the child alone. You are ruining him this way." When one is strict and the other is very lenient, then it is very natural for the child to love the lenient parent and to hate the strict parent. This is destructive, and there must never be a quarrel in front of the children. Instead, there must be a cooperation between the parents on the matter of how far the strictness will go and where the leniency will stop, so that the child understands that this thing about which his father shows strictness, he should not do again. And the leniency of the mother, take note. It could just as well be the reverse. It makes no difference. I am only saying it now as an example. It means that in the end he can be forgiven, that he did not do something terrible that would leave him unforgiven and bring him before the sanctions of his parents. This can happen in school too, and everywhere. I remember once we had a teacher, departed now, I believe. I say I believe because he might still be alive. He could be 90 years old. He was a strange man. He was a mathematician. He was a neurotic. And what I am about to say is literally true. He used to bite the students when they did not know their lesson or were misbehaving. Once I asked the boy next to me, he was teaching us geography. I asked him for the eraser. Take note, I asked him for the eraser. And that man, being a nervous person, a very nervous person, comes and grabs the globe, the terrestrial sphere from where he had it on the desk while he was teaching, and he came to smash it on my head. Of course, I dodged it, and he threw me out of the class over what? Take note. An eraser I had asked from the boy beside me, nothing else. He took me to the headmaster. He was terrible. That is, this man was the dread and terror of the students. Of course, I should tell you that at some point he grew gentle, and since there is a play by Shakespeare, "The shrew that became a lamb," I used to say. The shrew that became a lamb, what made him grow gentle? The hunger of the occupation, which made him another man in the end, and he became sober and clothed in his right mind, and he loved the children. He changed completely, 180 degrees. In any case, in the time when I was a student, he was like this. So I went, he took me to the headmaster, and the headmaster knew the man, that he was excessively strict. And he says to me, "All right, my child, and I was crying. I was perhaps in the second year of the 8th grade gymnasium, around 12 years old, that is, somewhere around there I must have been, and the headmaster was consoling me. "All right," he tells me, "do not cry." Indeed, at the teacher's demand that my guardian come, we considered it a very big thing for the guardian to come to the school. And what was it, after all? At that point I started crying, and he said to me, all right, there is no need for your father to come." Perhaps he knew what kind of man my father was. It was a different era. The older listeners will understand me and make allowances for me. What I mean is that the headmaster showed an understanding to help, while the other showed an excessive strictness. I cannot say that even that unreasonable strictness did not help me, just as the kind manner of the headmaster also helped me. So, what I read to you earlier from Chrysostom, Mark was helped both by the strictness of Paul and by the leniency of Barnabas. Paul takes no account of persons before the work of God. He could have been influenced by this fact. Mark's mother was a very important person in Jerusalem. She had made her house available, and the gatherings were held there. You remember that when Peter was released from prison by the angel on the eve of his execution, that is where he went, to the house of Mary, the mother of Mark. He went and found the church praying earnestly for his own salvation. So the mother of Mark was a very important person. Paul with a great heart, Paul with a very great heart, takes no account of this. With Mark, Barnabas, as I told you, lets his feeling begin to prevail. Well, he was a young man, his nephew, after all. Ah, what a fearful thing it is when the family element is involved. We make allowances when family is involved. I say this so that you know it. No one can remain objective when family ties are involved. In any case, the point is that both Barnabas and Paul had a good conscience. In reality, they possessed a good conscience, and this was very important. Both of them were looking to the work of God. There were no personal interests, there were none, but rather the pursuit of the interest of the work of God. And we move on to the next two verses. "And there arose a sharp contention, so that they parted from one another, and Barnabas took Mark and sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. There arose a certain sharp contention, so that they separated from one another. And Barnabas took Mark and went to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and was commended to the grace of God by the brethren of Antioch. And as we know, he went to the southern coast, forgive me, to the southern region of Asia Minor, to the very place where he had gone together with Barnabas. Paul together with Barnabas, and Cyprus too, remember, and the southern region of Asia Minor. The one takes the one region, and the other takes the other region. Now, let us look here. A paroxysm arose." These words are essentially medical terms, meaning the highest point that a fever reaches. What he means, and do not forget, is that Luke is a physician. Do not forget that. A foreign researcher has picked out a great many words, that is, selected them, from Acts and from the Gospel of Luke, that are medical terms. It is quite natural. And here too, I find myself recognizing the author through his vocabulary and his style. Luke was a physician. It was only to be expected that he would use a corresponding vocabulary, which means that a state of anger and irritation came over the relations between the two men, Paul and Barnabas. It seems that Mark's conduct at that time had displeased Paul or cost him dearly. Perhaps his absence had even worn them out, since they were left without a helper. In any case, it seems Paul had been keenly disturbed, and now that disturbance he had felt back then was coming back, and since it had been to the detriment of the missionary work, it now made him take a hard stance. In any case, as John Chrysostom says, an authentic researcher and interpreter, a paroxysm arose, he says, not enmity. A paroxysm came about, but no enmity came about. Take note of this. This is where some superficial student might say that an enmity arose between Barnabas and Paul. And do not forget, furthermore, that Paul owed much to Barnabas. He is the only one in the whole church of Antioch who had not been scandalized. Barnabas, because Paul had gone to Damascus as a persecutor, and so the one who introduced Paul into the church is Barnabas. Let us not forget this. Someone might say, perhaps, that it was a matter of basic gratitude. Yes, but as we said, when it comes to the work of God, nothing can stand above it. You may have done me good, my brother, But if at this moment you are becoming an obstacle to the work of God, I will not listen to you, and so I may appear to be ungrateful, but that does not mean I truly am ungrateful. We shall see this a little further on. It means that there was no hostility, simply a difference of opinion, not hostility. I underline this. And John Chrysostom notes this with great psychological insight and deep humanity, the very point I mentioned to you earlier. Indeed, then even from this, the human side is shown. Even here, the human positions become visible. They did many things also by human reasoning, he says. Many things they did with their human way of thinking. For every movement made by a man of God does not mean that it is inspired by God. Note that there remains room. There remains room also for the working of human thought. We will see a little further on, in the next chapter, when Paul reaches the north of Asia Minor, along the coast to the north, somewhere near Troas. And the plan he has, Christ does not dictate the plan to him. We said the people are not pawns. He draws up a plan. The plan he has, then, is to go to the interior of Asia Minor, that is, toward Ancyra. Yet the Spirit of God did not permit him, did not let him. And there comes that well-known vision of the man of Macedonia who says to him, Paul, cross over into Macedonia and help us. Once you have crossed Macedonia, meaning by way of the Bosphorus, the Hellespont, come and help us. And then Paul says that he was brought into agreement with the will of the Lord and took a different course. Yet he did have a route planned out. So this is what John Chrysostom wants to say here. The saints also have their own judgment. It does not mean that whatever they say and whatever they do, the Spirit of God moves them in some mechanical way. That is why they also did many things by human reasoning. They did many things with their own human understanding, with their own thinking. For they were not stones, not wood. He says they were not stones and wood. That is, people who are nothing, who go wherever you push them. No, hence the differing opinions. Take note, hence the differing opinions. And both opinions may at times be good. One may be better than the other. In any case, it is the different vantage point from which one might view a matter compared to how someone else would view it from another vantage point, from another angle. The human factor and the human assessment of things within the church, we would say, exist from God. Otherwise, freedom is absent, and people are turned into pawns. We also have a case which is not written in Acts, but is nonetheless mentioned in a letter of Paul. There we see that, at one point, a break had occurred with the Apostle Peter. Again, it was over an ecclesiastical matter. The situation was this. Peter was in Antioch and was doing missionary work. There was no issue about meat offered to idols. This, moreover, was before the Apostolic Council. But when they came, he was eating anything. Take note, you did not ask at the table whether this meat was sacrificed to idols or not. At one point, some Judaizing Christians came from Jerusalem, and I do not know. They asked. They learned that this meat now on the table was from things sacrificed to idols. And the Apostle Peter acted as though he were not eating it. Notice this, he acted as though he were not eating the meat. That is, he was being a hypocrite. And the Apostle Paul says to him, right there at the table, before everyone, Paul himself says it, before everyone, he rebuked Peter for the very things he had set aside. In other words, there is no real issue with foods offered to idols, so why are you building all that up again? Why are you going back to it again? He rebuked him for this, because Peter had come to look at it that way. So you see the human element at work, the human element fear. Take the prophet, Elijah. God speaks to him, when he had stood so bravely through such astonishing events in the northern kingdom. At one point, when he learned that Jezebel was going to kill him, and indeed she said, as he killed my own prophets today, meaning the priests of shame, I too will make him like one of them, I will kill him. When this man, so courageous, was struck by something, he was afraid. Fear took hold of him, and he began to run and run and run and run. He went beyond the borders of the northern kingdom. He went beyond the borders of the southern kingdom too, and he made for the desert to save himself. There he grew exhausted from running, and he even left his servant behind so that he could keep running. He fell down and slept, and an angel brought him food and said to him, you still have a long road to travel. He reached Mount Horeb, which is a peak of Sinai. When he arrived there, God said to him, Elijah, why have you come here? This was not simply for God to learn the answer, but it was also a little. we might say, a lofty irony. Well now, you, the brave one, how is it that you came to be afraid? Elijah says, Lord, they have torn down your altars. No one worships you. I alone worship you, and so on. Because the prophet Elijah had a great deal of self-confidence, and of course no one is perfect. For this reason he is now reproved by the Lord, who says to him, How is it that you came here? That is, you are afraid. You the brave one. How did it happen that you became afraid? My beloved, there are some things perhaps very subtle, but they are human, and they show that God lets a person, at times, suffer something, and see what is still lacking in him. To the Apostle Peter the Lord did not say, You will defend me. This very night I tell you, you will deny me 3 times, and so on and so forth. This is the human side. God does not abolish the human side, but he reveals it so that it too may be corrected. So I will return to this. There is no sin in holding a different opinion. As here, with Barnabas and Paul, even if it reached the proportions of a paroxysm, because it sprang from good motives, as I told you, the matter would be different. However, if each of them were seeking his own interest, the one who seeks his own, says Chrysostom, was provoked. The one who seeks his own was provoked. That is, if each sought his own way, then they would grow angry. And what else? Or by seeking honor for themselves, that is, that honor be given to me for the opinion I put forward, that I not be deprived of some honor. But in matters of method and work, as I told you, each one has his own different understanding. This is what John Chrysostom says, then. In that case, what crime is there? If each one holds a different opinion, where is the crime? Notice, let me comment a little here. Spouses hold different opinions on many things, certainly, and both may be right. But if each one states his opinion, not because he wants to prevail, but because that is how he sees it, that does not mean his opinion is bad. Where is the crime? John Chrysostom asks. Someone might say that what happened between the two apostles was a misfortune. As an event in itself, yes, it was a misfortune, an unfortunate case. But in terms of its result, it is not an unfortunate case. How so? Look at what John Chrysostom says. I will say it again, the authentic interpreter, a greater good came about through their parting. And the matter took this as its occasion. That is, the greater good was that they should part. The fact that they parted was simply some incident that separated them. An occasion. Notice, an occasion. So then the cause is not what is here, rather, out of good motives, they were to part. Notice they were to part. And this was the occasion, that is, this, so, called misfortune, was merely an occasion for the separation to take place. Why, you will ask? Because two heads could not exist in one work. Just as in headquarters, two generals cannot be together. It is not possible, because the one head would be bound by the other in matters of organization and tactics. When one would say, let us do this, and the other, so as not to cause a rupture, would say, let us do this, but in fact held a different opinion. Why? Because we have two heads, remarkable heads, God-inspired heads, which is something very great. Therefore, the separation was indeed an unpleasant case, but a fortunate occasion, and in our own lives too. My beloved, God permits bitter and unpleasant occasions in our relationships, but ones that are very beneficial in their results. Somewhere we stumble, somewhere there is a mishap, that is, something failed to happen. And we say, what a pity, and how many times does this turn out for a good result? And John Chrysostom continues and says, what then? Did they depart as enemies? That is, did they depart with malice? As enemies? God forbid. Notice God forbid. For you see, after this, Barnabas received many words of praise from Paul. In his epistles, in his letters, Paul adorns Barnabas with many words of praise. But something else as well, concerning Mark. Mark may have displeased Paul, and Paul may have been strict. Yet what does he write to Timothy in his second epistle? Listen to what he writes. Take Mark and bring him with you. That is, take Mark with you and come. For he is useful to me for ministry. That is, because he is useful to me in the ministry of the gospel. Back then he was useless to him. Paul stood firm. Now he is useful to him. But why else was the separation a fortunate one? Not only because two heads could not work together, but also for this reason, there came to be two pairs. Each self-sufficient. Paul could not have subordinates as long as Barnabas was with him. Now that they part, he can organize his staff with many co-workers. Another fortunate development. And so we have two pairs in terms of leadership. Barnabas takes Mark, Paul takes Silas, and soon he will take Timothy, and a third and a fourth and a fifth will be added. Many co-workers for Paul, because now he is the general who lays out the plan of the mission. So he had to part ways with Barnabas. What impresses us, though, is Luke's honesty as a historian. For he does not hide the shadowy points of the church or of individual persons, but sets them out before us. He sets them out with the familiar coolness of the historian. This is of very great importance, because it makes no difference that Luke, one of Paul's fellow workers, may well have Paul as his hero. He states the shadowed point, if it is shadowed, that is, that Paul reached the point of a paroxysm and appeared absolute. He does not hesitate to write it, as in a host of other cases where we have a precise historical, we might say, honesty. Furthermore, the four Gospels, the four evangelists, have the following two characteristics, which are the marks of a sincerely classical historian. First, they set out the events as they see them, and second, they never take the side of one party against the other, nor do they revile. Nothing, objectively, entirely objectively. These are the virtues of a historian, of a person who wishes to write history. Of course, we would say it is a merit for any person when he sets out a situation with objectivity. Unfortunately, we do not have this, my beloved, and indeed sometimes even in these places of confession. I do not hold it against anyone. It is a matter of ignorance, a matter of strong subjectivism, when we want to say something. And we make, to put it in the plain Greek you use here in Thessaly, we make a single hair into a thick rope, so that the other person is astonished, and begins to say, my, what is this? And what is that? The spiritual father, the priest, and every person, when he hears something, must not rush at once to give his opinion, but if he can, through the narration, to discern the objective truth. And not as the information is offered to him subjectively. In any case, blessed is the one who can see, within a space full of subjectivism, see the matter objectively, or seek to place the matter objectively. If he is swept away by a morbid sentimentality and is stirred up, notice what I am telling you, stirred up to act, he will bring about terrible damage. This is so in every area of our life. Your little child comes crying that the neighbor woman said harsh words to it. You, the mother, let us say, and alas, the fathers are like this too. You go straight outside, what shall I do to her? You'll see, the wretch, forgive me. That is how you talk. I am repeating exactly what you say. And you go and get into a quarrel with the neighbor woman. The thing is very simple. A little while later, the children who had quarreled, ours with the neighbors, have made up and are playing together as friends. We are the ones who fought. Why? Because we do not have composure to seek the objective truth. It is very important, please. It is very important. You see, all these things make our life either hard or easy, depending on how we position ourselves. In the end, Barnabas took Mark along as his helper and sailed off to Cyprus, which was also his own homeland. At this point, I must tell you, this is the last mention of his name in the book of Acts. Barnabas will not be spoken of again in Acts, and this is quite natural, because Luke was a companion of Paul. So the historical material he gathers comes only from Paul's own company. It is just as in the book of Acts more generally. We do not have the activity of the other apostles, but only what happened in Jerusalem, the death of John, and only there do we have a reference to John himself and to the other apostles. It is not that the other apostles were inactive, rather, their activity simply was not recorded, and that is because Luke could not gather material from the work of every single apostle. So this is the last mention made of him here. In any case, since Barnabas was a Cypriot by birth, he was a Cypriot Jew, or, more precisely, a Levite, from the priestly order of Levi, but he lived in Cyprus, or was born there. These are the Jews of the diaspora. They kept their people, their identity, and their faith, yet they had scattered throughout the world as it was then known, the so-called Jews of the diaspora. So in that sense, Barnabas was a Cypriot. Of course, apart from Cyprus, which he now traveled through together with Mark, he traveled to many other places as well. But toward the end of his life, he returned to Cyprus, where he ended his life as a martyr, having been stoned to death by Syrian Jews in the city of Salamis in Cyprus. Paul chose Silas, and he too set out to inspect the churches of southern Asia Minor, as I told you earlier. Silas, of course, is not a servant, but a helper in the preaching, to baptize and to preach, yet not a servant in the sense of cooking, washing clothes, and so on. So Silas is a precious helper, as proves to be the case in the end, in the evangelizing of the nations. And again, here we see them being handed over by the brethren of Antioch to the grace of the Lord, as the passage tells us. Everything must be done with the blessing of the Lord in order to prosper. Nothing should be done without the blessing of Christ. And the faithful ought always to pray for those who labor at the work of the Lord. And we go to the next verse, the 41st. He went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. That is, Paul was passing through, going through Syria and Cilicia. Cilicia was a province of Asia Minor. What was he doing as he passed through the cities in which Christ had been preached? He was strengthening, that is, he was supporting the churches. Paul visits, first of all, those churches which were liable to receive that corrupting presence of the Judaizing Christians, because the letter is addressed to Cilicia and to Syria as well. If you recall from the Apostolic Council, he had to go there first to strengthen them after the shaking. They had suffered from the Judaizing Christians. He also had to strengthen them in the faith, since they were living among idol, worshipping peoples, and in love as well. For love in its Christian dimensions was of course unknown. It was unknown to the ancient world. John Chrysostom writes, "See the wisdom of Paul. Look," he says, "at Paul's wisdom." He does not first go on to other cities before visiting those that had received the word. In other words, he does not go to other, new cities, he says, unless he first goes back to those cities that had received the preaching. With this passage, the 41st, my beloved, the 15th chapter of the book of Acts comes to an end, and we enter the 16th chapter. The 16th chapter has quite a few interesting things, as with God's help, we shall see as our subjects progress. And we take the first and second verses of the 16th chapter. He came to Derbe and Lystra, meaning that Paul arrived at Derbe and Lystra. And behold, there was a certain disciple there named Timothy, the son of a certain believing Jewish woman, but of a Greek father. And behold there, in Lystra, sometimes feminine in gender, sometimes neuter, earlier. When we first spoke about this city, I had explained it to you. There, it says, was a certain disciple, meaning a Christian disciple. For disciple is one of the names of the Christians. The name disciple, who was called Timothy, and he was the son of a Jewish woman, who, however, was a believer. And his father was a Greek, that is, an idol worshipper, a pagan. Timothy even had his name from his father, that is, his father gave him this name. As we shall see further on, Paul did not give it. He was well attested by the brethren in Lystra and Iconium. Timothy had a good testimony from the brethren of Lystra and Iconium. There begins, as we see, the journey of Paul, who did not go to Cyprus, since, as he said, Barnabas went to Cyprus. With Silas as his helper, he heads from the lands of Syria toward the west. That is why he places Derbe before Lystra, whereas in the first apostolic journey he told us Lystra, Derbe. Now he tells us Derbe, Lystra, because he is moving from east to west. When Luke wants to draw our attention to something very important, he always begins with behold, which means look, look, behold. This event indeed was a great one. It was the finding and the gaining of Timothy, who would become Paul's helper. And the Timothy we know is the one to whom Paul later, much later, sends his two epistles to Timothy. Timothy was a very important person, as we shall see in what follows. So Paul arrived at Derbe, and from there at Lystra. Who was this Timothy, for whom it was as though he went especially, this Timothy, to Lystra? He was a disciple, Luke tells us. What does this mean, that Paul had drawn him in, chiefly during his first journey at Lystra, which is why later he will write in his first epistle to Timothy. To Timothy, my true child in the faith, I address my letter to Timothy, who is my true child in the faith. For at that time, when Timothy heard Paul, he must have been an adolescent. We are speaking of a difference of 4 years from the first apostolic journey, about 4 years. And he was drawn to the faith. Timothy, as we see from Luke's information, had a Jewish mother and a Greek father. His mother, as we know again from an epistle of Paul, was called Eunice, a Greek name, mark this. She was faithful to God, to the true God, faithful, and that is why Luke writes of a certain Jewish woman, a believer. Even though her husband was a pagan, an idolater, as a result, their child Timothy was, of course, not circumcised, as was surely wished. Forgive me, the mother certainly did wish to have her child circumcised. But the father, who was an idolater, would not accept this. Likewise, we know again from one of Paul's letters to Timothy that his grandmother, on his mother's side, was also living, a woman named Lois, and this too is a Greek name. Clearly, then, Timothy was the offspring of a mixed marriage, and about this mixed marriage we will speak, God willing, next time. A marriage which, of course, is forbidden by the Mosaic law. But the rest of Timothy's story, God willing, we will see next Sunday.